Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to today's webinar, Quality Enablement Webinar, Test Plans That Reduce Risk, brought to you by Dr. Dobbs and Microsoft and broadcast by United Business Media Limited. I'm Eric Bruno, and I'll be your moderator today. We have just a few announcements before we begin. You can participate in the Q&A session by asking questions at any time during this webinar. Just type your question into the Q&A text area to the right of the video window, and then click the Submit button. At this time, we recommend that you disable your pop-up blockers. The slides will advance automatically throughout the event. You may also download a copy of the slides by clicking on the Additional Resource button located below the presentation window. If you are experiencing any technical problems, please visit our webinar help guide by clicking on the help link below the presentation window. In addition, you can contact our technical support helpline, which is also located in the webinar help guide. Now, on to the presentation, Quality Enablement Webinar, Test Plans That Reduce Risk. Discussing today's topic is Mark Midland, Director of QA, Application Insights at Microsoft. Mark Midland is the Director of QA for the Application Insights team, which has just delivered visualization and modeling, unit tests, task management, code review, profiler, debugger, and IntelliTrace diagnostics into various editions of Visual Studio 2012. Prior to joining the Application Insights team, Mark was a group manager leading a team to ship Visual Studio Test Professional 2010. Over the past 17 years, 10 at Microsoft, Mark has been a developer, consultant, and manager in a wide variety of roles and industries. Over the years, Mark has been able to combine a passion for quality with a strong belief in the power of agile methods and short release cycles to help numerous teams to ship better software with higher quality. And now, on to the presentation. Take it away, Mark.
No, thanks, Eric. So I thought I'd start out as controversially as possible, particularly given that my title is a director of test, and ask why do we even test anymore? Why even have a test discipline anymore? You know, the answer to that 20 years ago was basically, if we ship something, Microsoft were to ship something out into the world with a bug in it, there's no way for us to take it back, and there's no way to get a fix out to you that's simple. I think those of us who are a little longer in the tooth will remember a time when we had our cherished collections of MSDN DVDs that we kept our media on, and we got a new update every month, and that was basically the only way to get updates to software. As the state of the art has advanced to where it is today, I can practically, build and send you a patch to a broken piece of software, using my phone or my tablet or whatever. So the question of how much of the manufacturing quality of software should tests be doing, and how much of the that is what's important. And I think the key for us is that really we're seeing ourselves switch from focusing so much on purely the manufacturing quality to looking a lot more at product quality. So when I think about the importance of what we're up to, I think about us focusing on giving the customer direct value. So what never let the development team put a step down in a direction that doesn't accrue to value for the customer, and that really goes to, building the right product, making sure we have that product built the right way, and minimizing the delay as we go through that. I thought today I'd talk about four topics that I think help to address that. The first one is test planning and how that can help us really minimize delay and make sure that we're building the right product and maximizing value. Our trusted regression suite's really about minimizing delay again and making sure we're building the right way. And defense in depth will again help us with the right way. And then some exploratory testing, which I think is probably the future of the test discipline as much as anything, because I think it focuses on how do you build the right product and how do you make sure that what you're building really is delivering value. So for test planning, you think about test planning as a activity that we've done historically. That's been about, let's write down all of the test cases that we might then we might want to test at some point in the future. Generally, test is doing this over on their own, in their own silo, thinking about what's the, how am I going to break the software once the dev guys deliver it to me. And I think that way of test planning is really not helpful in the world where we can really push the product out to the customer every 2 or 3 weeks, or if you're on a website every week or every day. So I think about test planning as helping us to drive the product in the right direction as fast as possible without sort of picking up extraneous effort. So you think about it as a testable definition of done. So together with dev and PM, test kind of sits down and says, hey, when you finish this user story or this feature or however you think about that, what's it going to look like? You know, what is it going to mean that it's done? What's the minimum definition of what it means to be done? And then we sort of encapsulate that somehow into a test plan. And with that, we keep dev on track. Say, just build these things. Build till these things work. Don't build anything else that you think we might need, or don't build anything that we haven't agreed that we need. The other thing I think we do is we sort of name the first 10 bugs that we're going to write for the test for the developer when he checks in. I've noticed over the years that the testers sort of have this secret stash of the first 10 things I'm going to do to this product the second the dev gives it to me to get out of the gate with my first 10 bugs. And instead of doing that as a adversarial thing, I think with the test plan we can say, hey, look, here's what we're gonna try to break the minute you give it to us. So go ahead and fix those bugs before you give it, and then we'll have to be a bit more creative as we're thinking about this. And then I think the last point here that is really key is that this is an output of planning. Whether you're doing, you know, sort of iteration based development or actual sort of, you know, weekly scrums or, you know, daily extreme programming, what have you. I think as close as possible to where the developer is actually going to write code, when that developer is doing planning, when the PMs are working with developers to do planning, that's the time to be doing test planning. So a couple of ways that we've approached this within my teams. First of all, we've used SpecFlow, which many of you may be familiar with. It's a sort of a cucumber-based .NET framework. And what you can see here is what we're doing as a team as we start is we're writing a declarative definition of what it means to be done with some particular scenario. And you can these are probably won't make much sense to anybody on the call, but you know these are things that we know have to be done by the time we finish the sprint for these user stories. Behind the scenes, then we kind of convert that into code that the developer can go ahead and write, or the tester can write, depending on skill sets and interests and matches and so forth. That now are executable, and if you notice in this case, they're executable really as unit tests sitting in the Visual Studio IDE or whichever sort of product that you're using to run your tests. It's you're capable of just running them every day. As a developer, I can run it, see it turn red, and then work to turn it green over the course of the day or the week, depending on the feature. And then I think the final thing we do is we get to what does it look like on a daily basis for the people that are going to stand up? What's that conversation look like? And for us, what we've said is, hey, we'll put this report up on the wall in the team room, actually it's up refreshing pretty much all day. And as a team walks in and walks by, I conveniently chose one where we were all green, but we walk by and we notice that, you know, hey, we're not finished with what we're working on. Are we working on the right things to get those specific things to turn green? Are we focused on getting to the right answer? So that's all well and good, assuming that your developers are willing to play along and your testers have the right skill sets. But another way to go at this is just to use whatever test case management tool you use. I'm here using Test Professional from Microsoft. But and say, okay, I can do the same thing. I can take a requirement and I can write down all of the tests, all of the acceptance criteria that I want to have. And I, you know, documented as a series of just here is the test that I'll run when I get to it. And here you can see just a simple one with a few steps. Here are the steps I'm going to take as soon as you get that. Now it of course means that somebody's got to go in there and execute these tests somehow. You know, could be over and over by hand. It could be that the testers will go in and use something like Coded UI or Selenium or whatever to actually implement some functional UI automation to get that going. But you know, we've got to keep pushing that over and over again. And then we need a way to track it. And in Test Manager, we use this Runs tab to do that. And that kind of keeps us rolling with you know, with the progress and making sure that we're not just building things to build things, that we're building the things that that really matter to us. So then I just kind of moving off of that a bit and talking about trusted regression suites. I think the key word here is trusted. There's such a difficult time to get developers in particular to pay attention to suites of regression tests because often their pass rates are sort of you know, something less than binary. You know, it's 97%. You know, I don't know if I should feel good that it's 97% or if I should feel bad that it's 97%. It, you know, I'm 3% failing, or is that good that I'm only 3% failing? What we've done to kind of push on this is really trim our regression suites down. So at the beginning of 2012, Visual Studio 2012, we are absolutely drowning in regression on my team. We had, as you can see, 14,000 plus test cases that we're running nightly, using 23 full-time vendors to get those run, and we're producing out of that 33 product bugs per year. And I kind of did the math and thought, gosh, that's, you know, that's not a very impressive run rate when you start to get down to we're basically getting one bug per two or three person days of effort. You know, I often say I'm a director, and I can find two bugs or one bug in 2 days. Right? That's not even a challenge. And we were sitting on an 80% pass rate, which meant that on a day-to-day basis, we were generating 2,800 failed tests that we had to go in and investigate and say, is this test actually is it actually a product bug, or are we just looking at a flaky test? Is, you know, is the test wrong? Have we just changed the product code? You know, 2,800 test investigations. We obviously were not getting through all those. By the time we shipped Visual Studio 2012, we dropped down to about, you know, 1,700 test cases, and you know, a third of the vendors, and we're sitting at kind of a 99%. Pass rate for our nightlies, and we have another suite of tests that we use pretty constantly called VSU Basics that we're passing right at 100% every single day. Like, I know when VSU Basics comes back with a failure that we have a product bug and somebody needs to be doing something about it. And, you know, 14 investigations a day is something that we can get through. So how do we sort of get there? I think it's all well and good to say that we should do it, but I talk about sort of pruning relentlessly here. I went skiing several years ago with a friend of mine, and as we were driving up to the ski area, I kind of said to him, you know, the ski limit sort of goes up and down as we go along this road, and I can't really remember what the speed limit is right now as I'm driving. And he said to me, well, what I like to do is just continue accelerating until I see flashing lights in my rearview mirror. And at that point, I know that I've gone too fast. And that's kind of the approach that we've been talking about, we've been using for how we prune our tests. We say, look, I'm just going to keep cutting tests down until something bad actually happens to me. Like I actually miss something that I care about, or I get a regression that I feel like I should have caught, or whatever. One of the key things that we did was set a time limit. You know, we said everybody gets an hour, which seems like a really long time to let your regression test run, I think, if you're sort of starting from there. But many of our test suites were running on the order of 10 and 12 hours a piece. And so I think that, you know, we by setting a time limit in an hour, we really pushed ourselves to bring the suite down to the right size. I think the next thing to think about is, do we have the right test, and are we using it for the right purpose? I often find that what we've done in QA, particularly from the manufacturing quality perspective, like let's not let any bugs out the door, is taken all of our functional tests and run them in any kind of combination that we can think of in order to test whatever problem we might think of. So, I'm worried about world readiness. Okay, well, I'll run all my automated tests against the localized builds of the product on different localized versions of Windows. But we're not really testing on purpose, right? We're not really saying, hey, what can break in that, and how do I focus on testing that? I think when you start to look at that and get focused on getting the right test, you kind of start to apply this 15-year test, which we kind of say, if I'm still working on this product 15 years from now, do I want to still be running this test? If not, then I probably shouldn't include it in our ongoing regression suites. Though it may be useful for my day-to-day regression as I'm doing development, I shouldn't include it in our you know, longer running servicing testing. And the second one is, really, should this test be automated? I think sometimes we automate it no matter what. You know, this is a really hard thing to automate. You know, let's go ahead and automate it. A good example is automating for localization. You know, the main thing about localization, honestly, is that somebody looks at it and sees if, you know, do we have clipped edges? Do we have multiple lines someplace? What have you. Not that we can run through all of the tests and they all pass, because they often do. I think that the next thing here is we want the test to be short, fast, and close to the metal. So, you know, if I can do it with a unit test, i.e. I don't even have to install, that's my first choice, because those tests, you know, take, you know, almost no time. If I can't do it with that, then I want an integration test that runs from a development test framework, a unit test framework, so that, again, I may have to install, but then at least I'm getting fast tests as soon as I get to that. When I need to test UI, I want the developers to put in some help for me in terms of you know, how do I write a test against your UI that doesn't include functional UI automation? Because those tend to be not only long, but slow and way far away from the metal, so they're violating all three things. So, you know, how do we push all of those tests to run faster and more reliably that way? The next one is about broken windows. I feel like if you're ever satisfied with a 90% pass rate or a 98% pass rate, or it's okay if a test is broken today, we'll be okay. I think you automatically start to degrade the quality of your regression suite, no matter how good the tests are. A broken test that I know is broken is worse than not having a test. In the case of a broken test, I think, hey, we tested that. It's broken. It was broken yesterday. I guess it's the same, so I won't bother to go look. If I don't have a test, at least I'll go look again. And so, you know, kind of back to the same thing as pruning, but also just you know, take flaky tests out of your suite and rewrite them until you get good tests. And the last one that has been key is every test runs every single day. So we used to have a concept here called a full automation run, which was different from our nightly automation run in that, you know, it was the sort of all of the tests that we could ever have thought to run, you know, which was actually, you know, I said 16,000 before. It was, you know, it was probably another 20,000 tests on top of that. And the question I asked is, you know, when do we run those? Well, we run them right at the end of the product cycle, right before we push the product out the door. And I say, great. So why do we only run them that much? Well, because they're P2 tests. You know, we only run our P0, P1 tests, you know, every night. I say, okay, so basically what happens is we get to the end of the product cycle, and we spend 4 or 5 weeks getting a test bed back into shape to find a bunch of P2 bugs, because P2 tests always find you know, lower priority bugs. So, you know, we just basically institute a rule. Look, if a test doesn't run every day, it doesn't exist. Just delete it out of source control. Just get rid of it. There's no reason to even think about it. So I think the next thing there is really, you're going to get what you inspect, not what you expect. And so I think maintaining really good line of sight visibility into how your regression suites are doing is really key to continuing to improve and getting a regression suite that everybody can believe in. I did include the middle one there that shows, you know, clearly we're not perfect, and we're, you know, we still are pushing hard to make sure that our tests run 100% every day, but we look at that every day, and it hits our inbox every day. I think, you know, when you look at sort of the continuous integration movement that, you know, started 10 or 12 years ago, I guess now, probably more, you know, that was all about fast feedback. Like, the, you know, when the tests fail, it gets right back to the developer, and the developer has to do something about it right then. I think that's the kind of culture you have to instill, and part of it is, first of all, just being able to measure what's actually going on in your suites. That kind of leads me to this idea of defense in depth. So I think, I kind of said earlier that one of the key things we want to do is minimize delay, and what I mean by that really is the distance between when we've created a test and when we are actually able to, this is between when we've created the bug and the time that we're able to find that with a test is key to keeping the developer focused and in the zone. As you move away from that initial check-in, the developer is going to move on to something else. You know, in a couple of hours, the developer may be working on a different user story. In a day, the developer may be, you know, working on a completely different sort of feature set. In a week, they may be, you know, completely off the code base that they were on. And because of that, the further out you go, the more context switching the developer has to do in order to sort of get himself back to on track. So we think about this problem as kind of a functional defense in depth. So we have a gated check-in that runs, you know, so there's gated check-in or continuous integration are sort of different sides of the same coin, right? So gated check-in takes a shell set, a proposed check-in, and runs all of the tests before it actually commits, and in that case, if it doesn't work, it rejects back, which obviously is very, very fast feedback. The next thing is a rolling build. So, we don't want to have every check-in take an hour because as each developer goes in, they're running a large suite of tests. But we do want to have that suite of tests running in order to give us an idea of what we're likely to find later on in the day as we go towards our nightly. And so, you know, think about the gated check-in as protecting the developer's productivity, the build, right? Like I can't, as a developer, check in things and make it so that my buddy can't work. I think rolling builds are where we start to think about protecting ourselves from likely regressions that are not immediately obvious. So I'm able to check in, and because I've made a change in my code, it causes, you know, a piece of functionality that I didn't expect to break. And the most likely ones of those should be in our rolling builds. And then the nightly basically is every other test that we feel like we're going to run. Again, you know, tests have to run every day, so the nightly tests are the rest of them. In order for any of this to work, you have to have a stop the line mentality up and down the stack here. So midway through the last release cycle, I was talking to one of my test leads, and he was saying that, yeah, you know, we have a rolling build, and we're pretty happy with it. You know, it identifies product bugs pretty naturally. It does what it really needs to do in terms of identifying the problems. But often the rolling build has breaks, and then the nightly build has those same breaks. And I said, well, why is that happening? And he said, well, because if the developer checks in like late in the day and the test breaks at, you know, 4:30 or 5 o'clock, a lot of times they'll say, well, we'll just leave that until tomorrow. And I actually had him go back and talk to his dev lead and say, you know, is that the kind of organization that we really are going to run? Is that how we're going to feel about quality? Is that it's okay if it's broken? We'll just come back in and pick it up tomorrow. Not only does it make the rolling build sort of seem a little bit like extra work, it certainly makes the nightly run likely to fail every single day, and that is just wasted effort then. So, functional defense in depth, I think, is great. As we start to look at what else we can do, though, one of the things that we took a look at is, hey, can we do something about our non-functional requirements? Can we make things that that aren't just in the spec or aren't just, you know, obvious regression type functionality part of what we do as we defend in depth? And the one that we came up with that we've had very good luck with is this idea of a performance rolling build. And so we have some tests that we designate as performance tests and have some measurement blocks built into the code so that we can measure across that. And with every check-in, that's what each little dot there is, with every check-in, we do another build do another run of our performance build to see, you know, where are we. In this case, you can see that you know, we're looking at typing. This is actually typing in the editor. We added a feature called CodeSense, and with CodeSense, because it puts some things into the editor, it has the possibility of locking up the UI thread and making it so a user can't actually get, you know, they actually get a little delay in their typing. And so there's an overall test for the division that tests this, but it's pretty far away, right? It takes us a couple of days to get the results back from this. So instead, we implemented this, which, you know, gives us results in really a matter of minutes in most cases. And you could see it's we've used it as a tool or sort of all along to push the time that we're delaying typing down, you know, day over day, week over week, check-in over check-in, really. So that kind of leads me to, like, the challenges that I see for us, you know, in terms of other types of you know, automation that we can do. Like, what else can we do to just prevent silly mistakes that we're making and do those things as close to where the developer might make the mistake as possible? So, you know, some of the things that we already do along these lines, static code analysis, we can do some of that. We can do some dynamic code analysis. So we have a tool called MemSpec that, you know, watches basically allocations of memory and looks for objects that have been orphaned and tries to tell us, hey, you know, you're leaking memory here, and that's eventually going to lead to a crash. But it's, you know, it's a relatively narrow understanding. We have some geopolitical stuff, obviously. You know, go look for phrases that don't make sense, or that, you know, particularly don't make sense, you know, as they get translated, and some API usage, right? Like, let's make sure that we're using the same APIs as, you know, Visual Studio is producing APIs that our customers use. Let's make sure that we internally are using those same APIs and not relying on internal things to get that going. That, you know, all about sort of keeping ourselves steady in code. But I look at it and I think, gosh, there's a bunch of things that I'd like to be able to do, that I would like to be able to say, these are just, you know, just something that happens every day with every check-in that we really haven't quite come up with a way to think about. So we think about, you know, world readiness. So there's some amount I talked earlier of localizability. So we have a tool that runs and creates a pseudo-localization, which, you know, basically takes the English word and puts a bunch of specialized characters on either end and makes sure that the whatever the translation is at least a certain character width. But that's fine, and there's some potential that, you know, that'll have some actual sort of crashing bugs, but those are very, very, very seldom. So how do we go about getting things like, you know, the localization is right, the clipping is wrong? How can I get to that faster? Our solution to this so far, unfortunately not a great one, has been to use a few of those vendors that I talked about earlier to just pick the product up literally every day and kind of walk through it and look for those world ready localizability kind of bugs. You know, another way we've tried to address it is through, you know, getting people to dog food and asking them to dog food in their native language, which, you know, we have folks from all over the world. So, you know, again, that helps some, but the distance from where the developer makes the mistake is pretty far. And you can see the same idea with accessibility. You know, how do we make sure that everything's accessible? This one seems tractable to me, and I worry that we just haven't put the time or effort into to thinking about how we would do it, right? I mean, can we access every control on the screen? That seems like something that we could automate and test in a way that doesn't really require intervention from a human. And then setup consistency. You know, today the way we check to make sure our setup works, honestly, is that we install the product and then take our functional tests and run them across there. But really, I mean, we ought to be able to say, hey, are all of these things signed correctly? Do they all look the way that they're supposed to in terms of signing? Are they all put down on the disk the right way? Do we have the right registry entries? Similarly, when we uninstall, do we end up with the same thing? Can we automate all of those things so that we get a very, you know, a good defense in depth beyond just what we can do from the functional perspective? So when we looking at the I was getting a little delay of the slide going up, want to make sure it got there. So when we look at sort of defense in depth, that's great. That's about making sure that we're building the product right. You know, are we making mistakes? Just in kind of what I think of as manufacturing quality, in terms of, you know, we kind of said that the product was going to do this functionally and non-functionally, and we should make sure that the product is doing what we said it's going to do. I think where much of the future of testing is going to be is in exploratory testing. So how do we think about making sure that we're building the right product, and how do we do that as close to where the developers are working as possible? Kind of like to ask myself this question occasionally. You know, you look at this picture and you think, well, that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense at all. But if you think about it for another minute or two, you're like, well, you know, maybe it does. We're saying, you know, there is a left turn, and I would like you to stay over to the right side of that. But the, you know, the way that it plays with the immediate visceral reaction is nonsensical. So, you know, this is kind of where I think we often get with our software is we have analysts or program managers or business owners or whomever kind of say, hey, here's what I need you to do. And the developer looks at that and they say, yes, I understand that. And they go off and they do those things. They go ahead and they say, yeah, I'm going to do exactly what it says. And then it gets to QA and we have two choices. And the easy choice, the way that, you know, I think sometimes we fall is we say, hey, my next thing is to do is I'm gonna go and make sure that I can test that the keep right sign actually is pointing to the right. I'm gonna make sure that the keep right sign is all spelled correctly. I'm gonna make sure that that arrow is on a yellow background and that it you know curves off to the left. And we get all of those requirements sort of put together as automated tests in many cases, or we. Take them in a test plan and have somebody run through them as regression tests, and end up with a product that looks like this. Our other choice, I think, is to actually do take a more exploratory approach. So let me define that, because I don't want you to think of exploratory in this context as you know sort of ad hoc or you know, pounding on the keyboard or just manual testing. I think you know, kind of standing on the shoulders of others here. James Bach kind of says that exploratory testing is simultaneous learning, test design, and test execution. And I think that's a pretty good start of what we're after. When I think about it, I add some more stuff to it. I think about it as being centered on customer value. We're not, you know, I'm not just exploratory testing. I'm exploratory testing to try to make sure that what we're giving to the customer is going to have value, not just that it does what we thought it was going to do. It actually solves a problem, one, that they care about, and two, that in a way that they're going to be able to use. And we're focused on finding bugs very quickly, and early in the cycle. And I know those sound like the same thing. When I say fast, I mean from the perspective of from the time you start testing until you start finding these issues, I don't want that to take very long. From the perspective of early, I mean, from the time the developer checks in the code, I don't want the start of test to be very long. And you know, over the course of the product cycle, there's a lot of things that contribute to that. So we've talked about some of them. A key one is actually getting the developers to partner and deliver their software in a way that lets us insert ourselves into the process very early. And with minimal test overhead, meaning, you know, we're not going to spend a bunch of time writing specs or you know, thinking about test frameworks or, you know, writing a framework to write our test framework on top of. We're just going to get in there and try to break the product as soon as we can. What it's not, and I kind of mentioned this, it's not unplanned testing. It's not ad hoc testing. And it's certainly not random testing. Nor really is it necessarily manual. I'll talk about that a bit more. So one of the ways that we've talked about, thought about driving our exploratory testing over the last couple of years is kind of combining. There's, you know, James Bach talks about an exploratory testing approach based on charters, where, you know, it kind of I have a session with an idea, and I've sort of made this backlog of sessions that I might want to go do. And as I go through and test, I identify more charters of testing that I might want to do, and continue to sort of groom that backlog. And we found that works well, but we found that we'd like to have something to help us sort of remember all of the things. All of the other things that we might want to do. So, how, you know, what are the vectors that we want to attack on? And so we've been using this idea of test tours. I stole not only the sort of tours from James Whitaker. Actually came up with the idea when we were working together in Test Professional. But I will admit to having taken his jokey title here. So I think that, you know, you look down these and you see a bunch of kind of ideas of different tours. And so just to kind of give you a feel for what some of these mean, you know, there's this idea of, you know, I'm a couch potato. I'm just gonna click through and take whatever default values I get everywhere and see what happens. And you know, this, you know, tends to find things like, hey, we're not actually making sure that, you know, you're filling things in, or we have appropriate defaults. You know, we get lots of crashes and that sort of thing. You know, sort of antisocial, like purposely trying to do things out of order, which I think is fun. I think the bad neighborhood tour is kind of a fun one. That's, you know, this idea that we want to test where the most bugs are. There's a team in the Xbox group called the Games Test Organization. One of the things that they've been able to do along this sort of idea of the bad neighborhood tours is to take the functionality that they have for a particular game and put it on a 2x2 matrix. And within that matrix, so, you know, one direction is sort of all of the characters that you might be able to play, and the other direction is all of the actions that they might be able to do, with the most, you know, likely stuff being in the center of the grid. And with that, they've been able to say, okay, where have people been testing? Are they, you know, have they been testing in, you know, in all of these areas, and also, I guess, just as importantly, is where have people been finding bugs as they've moved through this, and sort of what are those bad neighborhoods? And we've done a bit of similar kinds of things. I think this is a great opportunity again for testers to come through and say, hey, we can give you a lot more information about the product using things like code coverage and so forth to really sort of figure out where are those bad neighborhoods? How do we identify those? How do we go through them? So I just to kind of take you through the way that we work through this is we kind of use our test case management system here to say, okay, what tour am I going to do, and what story is that for? So I'm starting out by saying, hey, these are the tours, for this story. I don't care about some of them, so I'll just either delete that case or mark it as something I'm not going to work on. The next thing is to actually go do the tour and keep track of the session. And I think, this has been a big positive for us. Is as we've been doing exploratory testing, I think one of the problems that you always run into in sort of this dev test ping pong is, I went and did a bunch of things. I went and did a bunch of exploratory testing, and I ended up in a situation where I found a bug. And the developer wants to know exactly how did you get to that bug. And so, there's different ways of doing this. I've heard of test teams that, basically, write down every step as they take it and make sure that they can do that. You can, certainly do sort of screen capture and that kind of thing. We use the test manager product again, and it does some of those things for us, captures a click stream, captures video, so just to keep track of what you're actually doing during that session being, of course, the key point. And then finally, we want to just be able to report out, and we report out kind of two different ways. One way is to say, here's a bug that I found while I was exploratory testing with a good amount of detail, so that you're able to look into the bug and hopefully reproduce it. The second thing is really a report out of the testing charter itself. If you kind of think back to the James Bach view of this world, here's what I did, and maybe I should go through that with one of my peers and talk about what are the things I saw? What risks do I now think about because of those? And should we be doing something in particular as we start into our next exploratory session? And then just sort of beyond that, so where do we go? Where do we go beyond sort of just being able to do tours and sort of that manual or interactive exploratory testing? One thing is, I think you have to measure up. So Conway's law, right? Software tends to expose the organization which developed it and breaks along the seams of the organization. One of the ways we've fought against that is to push a team, up to really the top level of the organization, reporting into me, and driving end-to-end scenarios went all the way across the organization, and making sure that we're really looking into the breadth. The next thing is in this idea of exploratory automation. You can maybe familiar with heuristic test oracles. Is sort of John Robbins has done a lot of work with that in Bing in. Yeah, I have a reference there if you want to go take a look. But the idea is, can I create some really simple rule that allows me to check the consistency of the answer, as opposed to just allowing me to get to the a yes or no, yeah, it's broken or it's not broken, that I can do in functional testing. So, a A quick example might be if I wanted to test Bing Maps routing capability, I could pick two coordinate points and ask for a route back from the engine, and then compare the route distance to the coordinate distance, and if it's, you know, X times bigger, then I should mark that as something that, you know, a human should look at later to see if there's a reason for it. You can go through, you know, sort of gazillions of tests that way really, really quickly. And then there's, of course, some brute force techniques. Let's go grab, you know, all of the projects in our sample store and compile them and run them through our debugger and make sure that we can, you know, we don't get any obvious breaks. You just sort of brute force. Again, those are helpful, but you know, when we can apply the heuristics, we get a lot more out of it. And I think the thing that, you know, is really pushing forward is how do we get customer value directly from our customers? How do we get that telemetry, evaluate that telemetry, and take a look at how satisfied are our customers, and how should we change what we're doing? Obviously, you know, services are really leading the way here. The data is easy, it's available, it's easy to add an instrumentation point. I think the idea of finding actionable information still remains a challenge for us. Like, how do we sort of parse the signal from the noise on our client software? That's a particular problem, because, you know, we kind of get a subset of all of the data that comes back, and it's hard to see what people have done. So we're working hard to try to figure out how do you string things together to do that. But I think overall we're sort of moving ourselves from a will this work kind of mentality to is it actually working for me today? Is it working for my customers today? So with that, I'll pause and see if there's any questions we can answer.
Thank you, Mark. That was a fantastic, insightful presentation. Next, before we begin with today's Q&A, please fill out the feedback form that has opened on your computer. To complete the form, please press the Submit Answer button at the bottom of the page. Thank you in advance for filling out the feedback form. Your participation in this survey allows us to better serve you. And now, on to the question and answer portion of our event. As a reminder, to participate in the Q&A, just type your question into the text box located below the media player, then click the Submit button. Okay, we do have a question here, Mark, and I'll read that to you. What was the tool you mentioned for dynamic code analysis? Mark?
So the tool that I mentioned, we call MemSpec. It's so far an internally available only tool, unfortunately. There have been some challenges with the tool, and that it you know takes your test run down to a sort of a glacial pace, and until we can figure out how to allow, you know, a 15-minute test run to not take 4 hours when you're running the tool, we're probably not going to push it out to the public.
Okay, great. The next question is, some people have said that it's best to define tests along with requirements, because if you can test a requirement, it means you can understand the requirement better. What are your viewpoints on that? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that, Eric. I think we have to be careful about how we think of the implementation of that. So I think when we define our tests along with the requirements, you know, we should do it kind of in two ways. So there's sort of the PM sort of test interaction, which to me is about, hey, I have this idea of what the product is that we should build, and a product and a solution that it's going to provide for our customers. And test needs to engage there and say, okay, do I buy this problem? Do I believe that problem exists? And then do I believe that this is a good solution for building the product? I think the second level, you know, kind of going back to what I was talking about in test planning, is about as a team coming together and saying, right, great. So we have this user story, which is, you know, really just a requirement. Let's make sure that together as a team, we get down to the bottom of what we think it means for this particular requirement to have been met. And I think it's a bit of a different take, I think, from what people are usually saying when they say define tests with requirements. But I think it's the same process, the same sort of work breakdown process that you see the development team go through, right? I kind of think about what the PM's asking me to do, and then I break it down a little bit more, and I get into a bit more of detail of what the PMs are asking me to do, and I start to build user stories, and that's kind of the sort of unfolding story of the requirement and into development. I think you're doing the same parallel activity as a test organization.
Great. Thank you, Mark. The next question is, how do we manage feature creep and test the resulting builds that come to QA at the last minute? I suppose the person means from a testing point of view. Mark?
I'm sorry, Eric, could you say that? Can you say that again? I caught half of it.
Sure. How do we manage feature creep and test builds coming to QA at the last moment?
Yeah, I think this is a huge problem. I think if left to their own devices, devs will certainly drop the code on us at the absolute last minute. A few ways that we've gone about trying to push back on that and control the feature creep at the same time is moving ourselves into the actual feature crews, right? So we sit with the development team, you know, we kind of think of ourselves as an engineering team, and as we're doing planning, we start pushing on them about things like, hey, I know you have 5 developers, and in theory that means that you could work on 5 user stories at a time, but if you start working on 5 user stories on the first day of the sprint or iteration or however you want to think about that, I'm going to get all 5 of those user stories on the second to last day of the last week of the sprint. And obviously I'm not going to be able to test them at that point. So how about if you deliver in a more serial manner? How about if you put more developers on to each requirement? I will tell you the first reaction from every dev lead manager and dev that I've ever asked to do this is, oh, it's more efficient if I do it by myself, which is fair enough, but I'm not really that interested in efficient. I kind of want features to come to me faster. Asking them to bring those features in quicker gives us a chance to make sure that we've got we're not getting sort of squished at the end. I think part about feature creep is always gonna be a problem, and I think the best that we can do is just try to say, like, look, if we're working on the most important thing, and we're all trying to focus on working on the next most important thing, and we're using a common definition of what it means to be done in functional and non-functional ways, we're gonna hopefully work in the correct order. And although we may not deliver exactly the features that we thought we would at the beginning, we'll at least all cross the finish line together. With a product that is hopefully, you know, great for the customer.
Okay, thank you, Mark. We probably have time for one more quick question. We're approaching the top of the hour. But here's the question. What are your thoughts on the difficulty of retroactively adding unit tests to an existing product that has none? Mark?
Yeah, that certainly is a challenge. I think we've taken two approaches here. The less successful of them is dump a bunch of people on there and try to sort of, you know, just put new unit tests everywhere that they could possibly go. It hasn't been super successful for us that way. The more successful way that we have been able to go is to say, as you do the next feature, you have to add unit tests for whatever sort of methods that you touch as you go along. And by doing that, you know, you get a slow growth, but fortunately, you get growth in the right areas. You get the growth in the place where the product's changing. And I think the sort of, you know, standard agile practice of when you find a bug, you know, write a test that breaks that bug, helps to get a good set of unit tests in the most sort of likely to break areas. So that's kind of the way that we've done it. It's definitely a difficult challenge.
Great. Thank you, Mark. That's all the time we have for questions. For more information related to today's webinar, please visit any of the resource links open before you. Within the next 24 to 48 hours, you will receive a personalized follow-up email with details and a link to today's presentation on demand. Additionally, you can view today's event on demand by visiting informationweek.com/events. Thank you for attending today's webinar, Quality Enablement Webinar, Test Plans That Reduce Risk, brought to you by Dr. Dobbs and Microsoft. This webinar is copyright 2013 by United Business Media, LLC. The presentation materials are owned by or copyrighted, if that is the case, by Dr. Dobbs and Microsoft, who are solely responsible for its content, and the individual speakers are solely responsible for their content and their opinion. On behalf of our guests, Mark Midland, I'm Eric Bruno. Thank you for your time, and have a great day.